Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Placer, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our returning guest host, fan of the site, Evan Hitchens.
Hello.
All right, so this is our special GDC list edition of the Perceptive Podcast, as none of us are actually at the convention.
Well, hurrah!
I guess so.
Yeah, no recording it live there or doing anything fancy. Maybe next year, everybody.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I only a few conventions I actually go to, but the one I really want to go to is CES.
I don't know. GDC always has, my favorite seminars to watch afterwards. It's always been, my favorite convention for anything. You know, you learn a lot more from a developer talking about their game and the nuts and bolts behind it than you do watching, just some other trailer again and again.
All right, so before we get started with some game news, there has been news regarding GDC this week. There have been a few cases of sexism coming out of the GDC crowd. First was the fact that there is a party, I think, hosted, I guess that would be Wednesday night, that had the IGDA's name attached to it, and they had, I guess, like women, dressed provocatively, dancing and all that. And it's caused quite a stir, considering that the IGDA is supposed to be, one of the more respectable groups relating to game development.
Not only that, but it's supposed to be a more professional atmosphere. I mean, this is something like E3, where, they're showing it off to, everybody. I mean, this is supposed to be there for developers. It's supposed to be a very professional environment for developers to talk about, game design decisions and the tools they're using and all that. This is not a convention to, sell stuff to fanboys. And so, having those sort of women there is even like more out of place, I feel.
So who's to blame in the situation?
One of the guys who resigned explained that he said he was like 3 days from like retiring from the board anyway or something, but he said that, they didn't specifically say like, hey, let's have booth babes, but they hired this, company to, do the entertainment for it. Not knowing for sure what they were going to do, but he said, in the past they've used, they had, brought booth babes in, so to speak, before. And he should have spoke up about that ahead of time.
Yeah, it looks like I was looking up some information I was reading earlier. I believe the company was Yetizen?
Mm-hmm.
Was a group, so...
Yeah, that's it.
Basically, it sounds like IGDA wanted to be there, for name recognition. They didn't care, who was funding the party, basically. So this group, stepped up, and they basically, went along, for the whole ride.
They're trying to have it both ways. They're like, well, it's not our fault that this company is producing this hard content, but I actually enjoy the time here, too. So, yep.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, I was at the, there was a Philadelphia Expo. I think they only came... It was only for 1 year. Mm. So when I went there, we actually had like a party. It was like giant. It was like almost like a mansion. We were having like a party. It was like all nice and fancy. So it definitely is a bit of a surprise to hear that, they're having this, more rambunctious style party, which is supposed to be, as we talk about, for, game developers and major people in the industry.
Yeah. Well,
maybe they just chose Ra, or maybe he wanted to see dancers. So there you go.
All right, so let's move on and talk about some game news this week. For me, EA, I know last week we technically, took a break from, trashing SimCity. We did, make fun of EA that week. But this week we're back with more SimCity news, as EA's president, looks like Frank Gibeau, I think that's his name, he basically said that DRM is a failed dead-end strategy. They obviously just figured this out, now. Not, a month ago or during the entire development of SimCity.
Yeah, let's see them put their money where their mouth is. Plus, let's be real here, Origin is their own version of DRM, and, there's no way that, Origin is ever going to compete with Steam, so they really need to just drop all of that, which is itself a DRM-based system, and, put their games back on Steam and actually let us enjoy them on there.
And don't forget, with that whole Origin service, I just read an article talking about how there was a glitch or some sort of error with their system where it allowed people to hijack other people's PCs. That's pretty nasty.
Yay!
That's awesome.
That's great PR, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And the article that I'm going to link in the podcast has so many really great quotes from him, including one where he tried to once again reaffirm the fact that EA didn't push the Always Online onto Maxes and that they wanted to do it from the get-go.
Yep. I smell a tomfoolery with that statement.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they talk about, like, oh, we were creating an MMO, not putting DRM into a single-player game. And let's be real, you know, just the fact that, you know, you can buy stuff from other people in the game and the fact that their criminals can come and wreck your town does not actually make it an MMO. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, again, the reason they're playing Maxis this way is that everyone knows that Maxis is EA and they're not some sort of different entity. Yeah. So they're trying to play, like, you know, good cop, bad cop kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he's doing the same thing with Maxis. They're like, well, Maxis is, like, all about DRM. We're not. We're all about freedom. Isn't that right, guys? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, totally, guys. Yeah, that's the story.
And when, like, the head of Maxis said, you know, we want to make, because that's the experience we want for the people. That was really, that was great, you know. Who cares what the users want? It's what we really care about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Apparently they don't care about, you know, taking care of their customers and, like, maintaining high sales for the long run.
At least they didn't argue this was their artistic vision, because that's not an artistic vision. That's truly, like, tied to business decisions.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard anyone say how great it is to have, you know, cities, you know, so small that you need to build these multi-regions just to have, like, any semblance of a structure.
Yeah, yeah. Did you guys see Yahtzee's review of SimCity?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
It's probably his best review in years. I mean, I love Yahtzee, and I think he's doing a great thing for this industry. But that blows any video he's done in the past, like, 2 years out of the water. It's so good.
And there's also the fact, one thing that really annoys me, that in the piece, there's no mention of all the fallacies people have discovered with the actual simulation aspect of the game. Like how traffic issues, how fire engines won't basically go to fires. They'll, you know, get stuck.
Yeah.
So there's no mention of that, or like how people have found exploits. And these are issues that, you know, they have no basis in multiplayer. This is stuff that if someone actually, you know, sat down and played the game, they would have discovered. So it really just adds a whole nother layer of bullcrap to, you know, how they're talking about, you know, they're trying to serve the user.
Yeah, I mean, everything they say seems to be a pretty bold lie, and they know they can get away with it with the normal consumer, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes, but people are so, at least especially more hardcore gamers, are so cynical that they're starting to, I mean, I'm sure it's hurting their sales by now.
Yeah.
I mean, their reputation was already bad, but now they're bordering on malevolent, so.
Yep, and according to the piece, they have sold over 1.1 million copies in the first 2 weeks, but they're, of course, not mentioning how many people, you know, took their refund, how many people have complained about it. And on Amazon, the game has actually gone down in price from $60 to $40, so it's already taken a $20 hit, and it hasn't even been 1 month of release.
Yeah, that's tragic.
Well, yeah, I also saw an article where someone hacked into, like, some basic stuff, and they saw that you can have harbors, but they're going to cost $15 DLC.
Oh, God.
Wow. And I'm like, wow. Yeah, it's like, wow. Really? They already have everything, like, planned. Like, this is, like, the most planned out, like, take-all-your-money game that I've seen in a while. But, yeah. Yeah, but what? It's just so, like, it's so obvious. They just, like, they're like, no, we're not even going to try anymore. Here, it's all out there.
What really just pisses me off about this whole ordeal is the fact they took the SimCity name and just, you know, ran it through the mud. I mean, if you look at the city building genre, really hasn't had a big hit in a long time. Maybe since SimCity 4. Like the Settlers 7, Anno 2070, they're good games, but they don't have that brand appeal that SimCity had. And if you look at this year, I think the only other city building game that I can think of is Medieval Mayor from Tilted Mill, which I'm really excited because this is their first game in several years. So I'm curious to see how they're going to take their model and bring it to today's market. But, I mean, with this, I mean, they basically just ruined the SimCity brand. Do you guys think that the brand itself is recoverable at this point?
Well, I think they also kind of ruined the brand by calling it SimCity without any sort of number to it. That's SimCity 5, just SimCity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now a whole generation will grow up as that's their first SimCity, is that one. And what a game to start off of. So, but, I mean, maybe it'll get better. But I still think a big detractor to people that have no idea what SimCity is having to download Origin to play it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, no one... I don't know anybody that's like, yeah, I like the Origin service. More like, hey guys, Origin has some sales going on. I'm like, no, not touching that.
Nope. Yeah. I mean, plus, you know, just by being away from Steam, I'm losing so many features, you know? Mm-hmm. And I can't sit there and talk with anybody else who's playing and, you know, see, you know, which ones my friends have. I mean, like, I don't want to have, like, two separate friends lists, all that.
Yeah.
Ace it, Steam wins.
And here's a bit of a fun fact. If you look at the Amazon reviews for SimCity, it has, in less than 1 month, they have, let me get the exact number here, they have 1,955 one-star reviews.
Wow.
In less than 1 month of being out. And to compare that, Diablo 3 has, after being out for a few years, 1,763.
One stars?
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
so eventually, Diablo 3 sort of climbed out, but they beat Diablo 3 in less than 30 days.
That's pretty
so
impressive.
Congratulations.
By the way, the guy, Jade Wilson, I think he's the guy, or I think it's his name, he came out today admitting that the auction house kind of hurt the game. Or
oh, yeah. The former director of it, you know, came out and said it was a huge mistake.
The guy that said F that loser to the original Diablo creator.
Yeah.
What an idiot.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, so maybe we'll see Diablo 3. It has been getting a little bit better, but I'm still waiting for the supposed big, you know, itemization changes that are supposed to come, I think, in two patches before going back to the game and seeing how better it's gotten.
I don't know if I could go back to it. Even though I own the game, I don't want to.
It's gotten a little bit better. The Monster Power System does help make it a little bit more challenging while giving you some rewards, but it still has the same systems of, you know, you really only have one real progression model for your items. That's the primary attribute. There is an actual end game now. They have, you know, like these super boss fights that you can unlock and get, you know, legendary gear. But what they've been talking about with, you know, complete revamp of itemization, that's not happening. I think someone said maybe by June.
Huh, maybe by June. Probably, maybe by 3 months after that. Sounds accurate.
Yeah, Blizzard time.
Blizzard time. It's not as bad as Valve time. Still pretty bad, though.
Yep.
Yeah. Alright, so let's move on to the next piece. What do you have for us this weekend?
I guess the CEO of Square Enix has stepped down. And I believe that Yusuke Matsuda is going to be in the post CEO. And I guess it's because of a lot of failures with things like Final Fantasy XIV, probably the most disastrous launch of all time for games, because they sunk about $150 million into that, and they got like a quarter of it back.
Oof.
And not even a quarter, maybe, just the initial sales. But they did not make up their budget. Because they still had that certain model to it where they had to pay a certain amount, and then they took it off. Because it was still like, they're still fixing things. So everyone that plays it doesn't have to pay. So they're not making any money from all these work man hours of fixing the game. So.
And that was for like, it was like free to play for what was like 2 years, I think?
Yeah, a year. I think, it, maybe even 2 years now. Maybe they never put the play back in there. But either way, a huge investment on like a very ballsy choice to remake it. But again, like we said in early cast, they should have just renamed the whole thing. They should have called it Final Fantasy Realm Reborn, not Final Fantasy numeric title.
Yeah.
Because people will still associate with 14 and assume nothing changed. So, there you go. So it's that. It's also, like, just the long cycles for development. Because, I believe Final Fantasy 13 Versus is still not out yet. Mm. And that's been, like, 2-3 years after. Or is it 2 years after, actually?
And that's supposed to be just like the spin-off of, or side story for Final Fantasy 13, right? It's not even like its own game.
It's like 13 in the present day. Some guy with pretty hair is like in some sort of like high rise. Anyways, the point is that it's a lot of these different games, probably the company not making a lot of money for some bad investments, specifically in their own division within Japan. I think they're losing a lot of money.
And the weird part with Square Enix is that if you look at their like PC lineup, they've been knocking it out of the park. They did Just Cause 2, Supreme Commander 2, Tomb Raider, Sleeping Dogs.
Yeah.
These are all really great games.
Deus Ex was their best, though.
Yeah. Pretty much, everything they got through acquiring Eidos, they've done a really great job of managing and really working with them. I mean, they're kind of on their own for, like, a Japanese company that's having that much luck with, American designers. I mean, I know, Capcom has some American studios, but, they're not knocking them out of the park like Square Enix is.
Yeah, it's I believe it's because this is a disconnect, maybe. That's why. There's, like, separation. And they just, like, we know what you guys are doing. Here's some money. And we'll just be publishers that way. So that's my theory. But I would say... that it's interesting that I got a report recently that they say that Tomb Raider, Hitman, and Sleeping Dogs was a failure, I guess, in cost. But they shipped at least 3.2 million Tomb Raider, so that's pretty good numbers.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they're expecting. They're expecting like 5 million. But these initial reports didn't factor in digital downloads, which is insane. But there's no reason. Yeah. The companies, I mean, you can goad retailers of what numbers come out, but you can't goad the straight up developers what the download costs were.
Yeah, and I know Steam does, or Valve doesn't like, releasing a lot of Steam numbers. I mean, sometimes they even have like issues with the developers releasing their Steam their sales through Steam in specific. So I can understand that they don't get all of that, but I mean, to not count digital distribution is, I mean, that's just insane. I mean, that's why we don't talk about NPD numbers anymore, because they don't count digital. NPD doesn't even count Walmart, so I mean, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, especially in this decade now. I mean, digital downloads have pretty much become firmly ingrained in gamer culture. I mean, how many people pretty much downloaded BioShock Infinite digitally?
Seriously, like a third of my TF2 team was like, "Oh man, I gotta leave once BioShock becomes available to play, guys. Just letting you know."
Yeah, a preload is awesome too.
Yeah.
And so, by the way, sometimes when games don't have preloads, that's what really angers me. I'm like, I got it online. I want a preload.
Yeah. Also, I want a TF2 hat.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be
exactly.
like everything should just come with TF2 hats.
Yeah. First of all, GMG, they had a service where you get $15 of any game choice, but we got TF2 hats instead.
Yeah.
Matters more.
I saw their sale, but I had already, I'd already done the pre-order on Steam, and it's cool that I could have gotten other stuff, but A, it gives me, these titles on Steam, so, my friends can see if I'm playing them and all that. But, my NG looks really good in that hat. Like, it really pulls the outfit together, and I can't believe I ever played without that hat. So I don't regret my decision whatsoever.
So that eye patch is awesome for the demo. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, isn't it? Well, like the NG hat, the Vox Diaboli or whatever.
Yeah.
I have the googly gazer, so like the one eye that's cut open is like giant on my engineer, so it's just fantastic.
I mean, there's some great combinations you can make, but
guys, if you think that is good, remember Poker Night at the Inventory?
Oh, the second.
Oh, did you
see
those leaked images?
Yeah, another one's coming out, right?
Yeah, and did you hear who the cast is going to be in that one?
Oh, it's sick. No, guys, there's leaked images out there. Like, if you haven't seen them, it's real.
Yeah, so they announced that the cast is going to be Brock from Venture Brothers, Claptrack from Borderlands, Ash from Evil Dead, GLaDOS, and Sam is there from Sam & Max.
So my question is, why did they pick Ash? Isn't he a movie character?
I don't really care.
Yeah, I mean, people really like Evil Dead. I mean,
there was a game. There was a game with him.
Yeah,
like,
there were a couple
ago.
Games, and Bruce Campbell's still a cool guy, from what I understand. And I assume it's him doing the voice. I haven't confirmed that, but it looks really good. It looks like GLaDOS deals apparently.
That's perfect.
So that's cool.
And of course, who's going to bet that there's going to be some Steam hats included in this one, too?
Well, yeah, yeah, there's supposed to be like five TF2 items that are available, because one of them is like a new Sapper that's based on Wheatley, if I recall.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. I saw the Wheatley one. He talks.
Yeah, yeah, which is totally cool for a spy. Yeah, I guess that's it'd be cool to attract attention.
Well, no, I don't think anyone else can hear it.
I guess you two are going to buy that game, then.
Yes.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, I played the first one. Until I got the miscellaneous item from Bioshock for the demo, I used the shades there, and I still use my Iron Curtain minigun.
Oh my god, I should go buy the first one. I wonder if you can get it with the second one. Probably. They probably put it together, because it's like $1, yeah. It's like $2 right now.
Yeah, seriously.
$2 hats sound good to me, but back to go ahead.
You gotta play it a bit to unlock those hats, though.
Oh, not a one to play it. Anyways, back to the last thing I want to say about Square Enix is, so Deus Ex is probably my favorite, release that they did. They definitely did the whole thing a service, because Deus Ex 2 was such a terrible, terrible game. But this one was a definitely better successor to Deus Ex original. And I guess with updated news is they're going to bring Deus Ex to the Wii U and fix the boss battles and give a new game plus so you can play after you defeat the game. So that's cool, but there's no information on if they're going to release it to the PC, which I think is pretty insane. So it's great that the Wii U owners get a game to play on their system, but it's also kind of bad that they don't support the rest of the people they've released the game on. So because I'm sure a lot of people would at least buy for DLC. Because those boss battles were pretty... That was like the worst part of the game. If it wasn't for that in the ending, it'd be an excellent game.
The boss fight for the Missing Link was pretty good.
Well, that's where they got the right idea.
Yeah. Well, of course, it was only just one fight, which is pretty much a shame, because as you said, that was like the one nagging point that I think everyone has brought up and just felt like every review of the game.
Yeah, all they did was outsource the boss battles. I wonder what they would have done. I mean, I wonder what the studio feels about the one that did the outsource. Like, man, we did a terrible job. Everyone hates us.
Yeah.
I also heard that no one played Deus Ex original on that team. I'm like, well, are you? Yeah, you guys need to do your research. I would assume you would do your research at least. Wrong again. So, so that's pretty much my news about Square Enix.
All right. Evan, what news do you have for us this week?
Well, also news about how much important digital is compared to physical. GameStop reported fully lost $270 million in fiscal 2012. Mm. So, I will say this. I worked at GameStop for several years. I have an idea, I've seen the insides of everything, I have an idea of how their business model goes, and I will say they're doing a good job of, realizing what the future is going to hold. They bought a digital distribution system, Impulse, which isn't big, but at least they have their foot in the door. They bought Kongregate.com, so that, they bought these other revenue streams, and let's be real, if they had started closing stores, earlier, they could have saved all of that money. Yeah. They've already clustered to the point that they've eliminated virtually all competition when it comes to the used market, in just about every area. So, they should have immediately started closing down stores. I mean, where I work, the stores are just incredibly clustered. There was a store a mile and a half down the road from the store that I worked at, and, I spent 4 years building that store up and doubling its volume, but a good portion of that was me just taking business from the other GameStop because I was a better salesperson and better manager.
But I think a lot of that cluster has to do with their acquisition of Electronic Boutique.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, that's GameStop started as Babbage's and just slowly bought more and more, companies, Software Etc. and Rhino Games.
Funko Land,
yes. Yeah. So I mean, all of that is just, they should have, started scaling back stores sooner, and, instead of being like, well, listen, we're not doing this because we're losing money, we're doing this because, we're anticipating the market changing, and that's how you get ahead of it. I mean, mind you, you know, it just came out like 3 months ago that one of their higher ups was embezzling millions of dollars. So there's that too. I mean, at least they're trying to get their foot in the door, and I understand that like people in the stores are now, you know, ranked a lot more strongly on selling DLC, much like, you know, they are for selling like subscriptions to their power up card and reserves.
Like the protection plans as well as that still
yeah.
like sale.
When I left, it wasn't something you were ranked on, but it was something that was occasionally talked about because it you know, it greatly affects profit and loss. Overall profit, because I mean it's such a huge markup on warranties. I don't know. They shift what gets ranked each year, so I mean it all depends on you know where they want to head the company. From what I understand, they push DLC a lot more. But I mean, really, you know, how much money is there really going to be in that?
I mean,
you know, they can't. They're not selling it cheaper than anybody else, so there's no reason to really buy it there except that you can buy it with trade-in credit. You know, and given that, you know, whether I'm paying, you know, the developer $20 or whether I'm paying GameStop $20 and then, you know, like somebody's getting a cut, you know, so I can't imagine GameStop is making much margin on, you know, like a $20, like Steam gift card or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're making most of their money on at least 50% of their revenue on used games. That's their big thing.
Oh, absolutely. And absolutely, it's 50%.
Yeah, and you're right. There's no real sales that goes on other than used games. There's no...
Yeah.
Like, all the sales we see online are great, but they're never passed down to the brick-and-mortar store. They're going to suffer the same fate as Blockbuster at this rate, because Blockbuster also did the online movie rental thing. But their library was, I don't know, like 3 games, so...
Yeah. But yeah, so...
And movies, I mean.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, we're going to see more of this. They need to... You know, I think they need to be proactive and close stores sooner. I mean, you know, things that we could talk about a few years ago of, you know, not everybody has internet. I mean, to a degree, that hasn't changed drastically. But the other thing that's holding, you know, downloads back, being overall hard drive space, and, you know, data caps. Data caps are gone. Netflix killed data caps because Netflix made it so easy for everybody to just instant stream everything. And suddenly, instead of it being like the most hardcore torrenting users when it comes to networks, you know, hitting that data cap that, you know, companies like Comcast would have. You know, suddenly, you know, everyday users who didn't know anything about computers were hitting data caps. So those are gone. As a result, you know, other countries may still have to worry about it. Like Canada has some really strict data caps where, like, you can't do more than, like, 50 gigs in a month. But the U.S., that's gone. And so now, you know, actually making it so people could download every game to their console... I mean, they could very easily squeeze GameStop even more out of the market and quickly. So they need to get ahead of it and close more stores than they already are, I think.
Right. And, you know, exactly. If they start to initiate their plan, because Kongregate does have a big base. The other one, I'm not quite sure yet. I've never even heard of them before, but I know Kongregate has a pretty good market in terms of Flash games. They're like the leader of Flash games and monetization policies and stuff. So
yeah,
a lot of developers tied to Kongregate.
Yeah, and a lot of developers, you know, came out of there and, like, got their start there. Team Meat, you know, with Meat Boy there.
All right, so let's move on and talk about some of the games we played. For me, I've been pretty busy this week working on some projects, but I have been finishing up Kid Icarus Uprising, which I posted my analysis about last week, and I did a follow-up post this week about the control issues. And Kid Icarus is one of those weird games that I really want to like it, but the control scheme is just so, I guess, just, like, difficult to play. I mean, I've been playing games for over 20 years at this point, and I can't play Kid Icarus for more than, like, 30 minutes without getting this, like, sharp pain in my hand.
Wow.
Well, I think it's supposed to be played with that extra analog stick, that extension, right?
It's an optional feature. The game was clearly designed for right-handed people, which also is like another strike against me as a lefty. Oof. Because you have to use the circle pad, like I said, it does both moving and dodging, so you need that extra bit of fidelity in order to get the dodge to work. So if you try to, you know, use the buttons, like you try to switch it so that the buttons are movement, you don't have that, which makes dodging even harder. And when you have enemies who all their shots basically hone in on you, just by normal, it just makes it that much harder. And then you can't really hold the stylus to do aiming and shooting because you want to use your left hand for that. So it's just like this huge mess. But the gameplay is really good. It has, you could basically make the game harder, and that gives you better weapons. There's like a whole like achievement list you can go down. And the story is like crazy. It's completely like meta humor. Like, they just, like, throw, like, modern-day references for a game that takes place during, like, supposed to be, like, the era of, like, Greek gods. Halfway through the game, there's an alien invasion.
So, I guess, I think, well, do you think the game would be better played on a console? If you up-resed it and give it a better polish?
I would say if it was adapted to a console control system, I think that would help. But then you sort of run into that problem still with the controlling, with, like, moving and shooting. Because having the stylus, I think the problem is that the stylus isn't one-to-one with where your targeting reticle is and where you're pointing. So you have to, like, sort of fight with the reticle to get, like, your hand in the right position so you're still moving the reticle around. And, of course, if you realize, you're only holding the actual system with one hand. So you're, like, trying to get your hands in this, like, weird position to try to hold and do everything. And the game actually came with, like, this little stand. But the problem is that the stand only was designed for the original 3DS, not the 3DS XL, which doesn't fit on it.
All right,
there
you go.
Why is Nintendo so terrible?
So, I mean, it's got, like, a lot of really good design. It was created by the same guy who did the Smash Brothers series. I think his name was Masahiro Sakurai.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, he definitely has a lot of great ideas with the design, but it's just so obtuse the controls. I would have loved to have, like, been there when they were, like, having people, like, play test the game and, like, talking about, so, what do you think of the controls?
It's like, they're all Japanese to me. Oh, well. You'd probably like it.
I think it's not so much Japanese as you need to have, I think, a third hand to play the game right.
Well, yeah. I was just making a joke before, bringing in, like, American testers.
Yeah.
But, as I said, I mean, it seemed like all the reviews seem to complain about the controls, too. It seemed like the game itself did it use the 3D, right? Did it do it well, or?
It was good. 3D is weird for me that it bothers me. I know some people it doesn't bother them. Well, for me, I can't play for more. I have to keep the slider either off or, you know, at, like, the lowest level. If I put any higher, it starts to give me a headache from playing it.
I see.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of 3D.
And coincidence, I could never do, like, the magic eyes as a child, you know, like those magic eye puzzles.
Can you cross your
eyes? Yeah, I was terrible at those too.
Wait, you guys can't cross your eyes?
I can try, but I could never see those things. It never worked for me.
Alright. Well, I'll train you guys. I'll show you how it's done.
Yeah, so it definitely is a shame. I hope they don't, you know, use this as an example of not to keep doing innovative things. Because, I mean, when Nintendo does go, like, out of the norm, I think they do a good job. I mean, Pikmin was a really great game. Luigi's Mansion came out of nowhere. I thought that was a good one. And they've said that the reviews for the newest one are pretty good.
Very good, yeah. I saw the video reviews of it. It looks really fun.
So it looks like the 3DS is, you know, getting into the groove kind of with the game developments. We're seeing a lot more games for it than we are for the Wii U right now.
Yeah.
It's good. Well, it's probably because it's actually profitable, and it's keeping Nintendo at least semi-afloat overall. Because, again, their biggest strength is their handheld market over all of it.
Yep. And as a quick aside regarding the Wii U, there has been news that EA is going to further, you know, distance themselves from the Wii U. They've announced that the new Battlefield game will not be making an appearance on the Wii U.
It's a vicious cycle, you know, because I'm sure they're doing it because there's not enough install base for the game to make a profit on the port itself. And then, but, you know, to get a bigger base, they need bigger games. So that's the issue they're having right now.
And they also said, according to one of the interviews, they were basically saying that part of the reason is that they consider the weakest system technology-wise, so they don't want to scale the game down so far to fit the Wii U.
That's a little bullcrappy, because the game's going to come out on the PS3 and 360, which are really old systems, And I'm sure the Wii U is comparable, if not better, than those systems. So it's just pretty much, I'm sure it's a business decision. They don't want to...
probably the control scheme as well, because as we know, the Wii U has, the control scheme is just completely different. So for them to spend money on the Wii U, they have to spend additional time developing a control scheme that will fit for the tablet system.
And don't forget, they took a loss on Black Ops. I mean, overall they made money on Black Ops, but I'm sure they didn't make their money on the development of it on the Wii. So I'm sure the Wii U, I mean. So I'm sure that's probably the reason. Another thing. They took a gamble, they didn't like it, and they're not going to do it again. And even small developers, like, we were talking about in our company that, like, why don't we, you know, put our game on the Wii U? And then it was shot down, saying that's not a big enough base, and we use too much money and time developing a game for a system we don't even know will do well on. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions around the Wii U, so they need to start reassuring third parties that their base is strong, that they'll give them support they need, and it won't be like the old Nintendo where they'll just tight-lipped about everything. So they really need to reach out. And I think during GDC, they have. They made a lot of tweets saying, you know, there was a lot of, methods and stuff they're installing into their API to be more friendly with third parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we'll have to see if they're going to be able to revive the Wii U at this point, because it has been hit really bad this last year.
I don't think it's dead. I just think it's in a coma, nearing death.
Yeah. It will be interesting to see what numbers, you know, the next Pikmin game would get for it, because I think, isn't that like the only really big Nintendo property that's been announced for the Wii U?
Yes. Well, don't forget there was New Super Mario Bros. 2.
Oh, yeah. And of course, Rayman was. It was supposed to be a big Wii U title, but now it's being poured to all the other consoles.
Probably hitting everything at launch.
Probably to make money. I think that's. Yeah. I think the real reason.
And Bayonetta 2, I guess that should be something interesting. I think.
Yeah. I mean that makes me want to play it. It makes me want to get a Wii.
I don't think I would want to. I'll wait for the reviews. We'll see how they actually use that system. And I wonder why they couldn't get any sort of investors to back up or fund Bayonetta. Because it was a very successful original start, so I wonder why they couldn't continue.
Yeah. And I really want to play a sequel, too, because I feel, you know, Bayonetta had a more interesting world than it did its interesting story.
Yeah.
You know, I felt the actual story they went with was kind of bland, but I definitely want to explore the universe they set up.
It's so Japanese over-the-top game that I gotta try it sometime.
Yeah, and I still really hope we see, you know, another Killer 7. I know last week I mentioned Mad World. That was another really good one. There is, I think they did announce, I think a week or so ago, like a sort of spiritual sequel to Killer 7.
Hmm.
I'm not sure who's doing it, though.
Isn't it like The Killer Is You, or whatever that's what it's called?
Killer's Dead, Killer is something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if Suda's making it, it might be cool, but I mean... You know, I feel like Suda's kind of dialed in his last two games. Like, for as much as I love No More Heroes, to the point that, like, my phone ringtones are still No More Heroes all these years later. You know, I didn't even bother with Shadows of the Damned or Lollipop Chainsaw. I mean, you know, eventually when they're, you know, cheap, I might pick them up and blow through them. But, like, No More Heroes was so, you know, just mind-blowingly fresh, and Killer 7 was just so surreal. To those that are just kind of quirky, rather normal games.
I think he's going to like the Robert Rodriguez kind of thing with movies, because he's kind of phoning it in with his movies. They're like, all right, well, you know, machete, exploitation, done. Like, when you do exploitation, it allows you to be lazy, have like issues with continuity, like just bad writing's allowed. And Suda's doing the same thing with things like, especially Lollipop Chainsaw. That's such a reference to old horror B movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, it also goes along with his other stuff, too. I think he's heavily influenced by exploitation, movie, cinema of America, at least. And, again, someone needs to rein him in. That's what I think. Same thing with Zack Snyder. He's another director that needs to be reined in. Both of them need to be reined in.
Yeah.
And going back to Suda 51, I still think Killer 7 was his, you know, magnum opus. I think No More Heroes was a really good game.
Yeah, Killer 7 definitely wins. Oh, no discussion.
Yeah, And even though I think it just got killed in early reviews, but then I remember he did an interview about, like, after, like, a few months or a year later, it just, you know, word of mouth finally spread, and he finally, you know, was able to, like, make a profit out of that game.
Right. And, again, you know, there's a lot of interesting developers out there, but the only ones that really stand out, and everyone knows, is obviously Hideo Kojima, Suda 51, you know, so.
And, the guy who did Ninja Gaiden, can't believe I forget his name, he just completely left my head.
Itagaki?
Yeah.
You know, he's like the resident douchey of the douchers of the game development industry in Japan. All he does is sexually harass women. That's all he does. He's like, let's make some really sexist games and sexually harass women. Done.
And then talk trash talk, you know, better titles than his games.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his five worst games of all time, Tekken 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, you know how it goes.
He's
by his own fame.
Remember when DOA got really popular in, like, the hardcore fighting game scene and, like, you know, high-level tournaments and all that and, sold millions and millions?
Is that sarcasm? I can't tell.
Yeah, because I don't remember that.
I know it did pretty well on sales, probably.
Eh.
It was, like, first release. It was, like, first... I believe it was, like, during the original, like, Three Systems' first launch title. So
I'll say this. Like, you know, they usually do all right as launch titles and maybe, you know, a little bit more on the other ones, but, like... the series doesn't have legs like other better fighting games. You know, if you look at, like, the value of Street Fighter, Alpha on PS2, or the Third Strike Collection on PS2, like, those actually kind of stayed up there in price for a while because people were still playing them. They were still sought after.
Well, Marvel, you know, there's a time Capcom.
Marvel's Capcom 2 was 55 when I got it. I saw it peak at, like, 75, maybe 80.
Yeah, you think about that game, just a random crossover becomes a huge hit.
Yeah, whereas, you know, I'm sure I could get DOA 4 on the 360 for like $4 right now.
Yeah, it's like we're talking about a little bit later, but the concept of, like, graphic fidelity versus art direction.
Yeah,
and a lot of those 2D games have great art direction and still stand to this day, while DOA and those, like, try to be more realistic 3D fighting games look ugh now.
Yeah, and plus their character designs are so bland anyway. I mean, you have to have vibrant character designs. That's what makes a fighting game. And, you know, for as much as they're like, you know, oh, you know, check out all of our chicks, I'm like, they all are bland, uninteresting, and kind of samey.
Didn't Tekken have, like, a bear?
Yeah, Tekken had a bear. And a couple bears, guy. I think.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Blaze Panda. Blue, like, and Guilty Gear games. I mean, I may not be a fighting game fan, but, I mean, those are just some impressive 2D animation and design.
Yeah. You guys hate Skullgirls, but I love Skullgirls, and that's amazing.
Hey, dude, I don't hate... Where is this hate Skullgirls coming from?
You're not playing it. Not...
Well, I mean, I got competitive TF2, and I got Bioshock right now. I don't have time for that.
Hey, no, we got
play
time
Skullgirls eventually.
Play it sometime.
All right, let's move on to our next game. What game have you been playing, Evan?
Well, Bioshock Infinite and competitive TF2. I'm still on my Highlander team. We have a bye week this week, lining up a couple, you know, practices and whatnot for the weekend. And I've been playing Bioshock Infinite, which has been fantastic because since they first announced the game, I've been on a media blackout of Bioshock Infinite. So, like, everything that I'm experiencing, you know, solely through the game first. You know, I really had no idea what to expect going in on it, and I'm, you know, keeping a little journal of my observations as I go through this. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I'll join on that. So that's my game of the week. It's also Bioshock Infinite. And let me just say, just like before, it has one of the greatest aesthetics and art style I've seen in any game in my life so far. They did such a refined amount of detail on everything.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, they don't have the extreme graphic fidelity of Battlefield 3 or 4, which has just been released today, by the way, Battlefield 4. At least the concept video and stuff looks amazing. But it has something different. And all the art and all the characters have a soul to them, specifically the main characters.
Yeah.
I mean, the only gripe that I have is that a big part of the game, at least the first 20 minutes, is all about immersion, like being brought into this world, experiencing without having to shoot anything, just being introduced at a certain pace.
Yeah. I mean,
And I'm going to say quickly my gripe is that when I was checking the game out, at least in the beginning, and when I'm like really expecting everyone's faces, a lot of people's got duplicated. A lot of men's faces got duplicated. There's a scene where I was in a shoe shiner shop, and the shoe shiner was shining the shoes of a guy with the same face. I'm like, come on, guys, details. You guys could have fixed this.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, yeah, I definitely run into spots like that. I feel you on that.
Yeah, but later, they should be lazy. And in the beginning, they should be like try to be as different as possible. That's what I would think. Because later, no one knows what things are shooting. But in the beginning, you know, you're going to notice when there's
two
faces. Yeah,
you're walking right up to people and talking to them and all that.
Yeah, I think that's another thing is you don't interact with NPCs enough, too. They're just there to create a sense of atmosphere.
Yeah.
I don't have much to say because I'm like one of the few people who are not playing BioShock Infinite now.
You didn't like the first BioShock either.
Yeah. Wait, I mentioned that in my post, too. I found, like I said in my post, I just found the whole combat system to be so unnecessarily annoying compared to other games at the time, like Clive Barker's Undying.
Clive Barker's Undying saying that was bad, too?
No, I thought that was good. That was the good example of what BioShock tried to do.
Right, right. Huh. I say that to me, BioShock shouldn't be seen completely on its merits of gameplay. They fixed that in Infinite, for sure. Mm-hmm. There's still some issues with it, in terms of some things are kind of the samey. But BioShock should be really seen as type of an experience. That's definitely more of an experience game.
Yeah. I mean, that's why the second one, I think, failed. Like, I think the second one polished a lot of the gameplay issues that the first one had, but ultimately, you know, you're exploring the same world, but, you know, in a less interesting way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the second one ultimately we like to pretend didn't happen.
That's because it didn't. It's not that it was a terrible game. The problem with the second game was that it didn't offer anything new to such a cutting-edge series.
Right? It was a soulless cash-in.
Yeah, it was completely a soulless cash-in. The first one, like, was just it came in with a giant splash, haha. but it was new. It was fresh. It brought in full. It brought instead of just a really crappy narrative. Just like some weird, you know, like the same kind of tropes you normally see. They brought in a lot of philosophy. They brought in like what happens if we had, you know, a society of the great and intelligence. What happens if we had that something that was based on objectivist theory and Ayn Rand. It was really cool to see all that and all the politics involved in it. And as you play it over and over again, you start seeing more and more details. And BioShock Infinite is a game just like that, but. Even though some people say they like Rapture better, I think the overall environment and art and everything, they have a lot larger gambit in Infinite than it did in BioShock.
Yeah, Infinite is a much more like living, breathing world, it feels.
I think part of that, from what I understand, is that with BioShock, the game took place after the society had crumbled.
Yeah.
But from Infinite, same place, I guess, during like the height or, you know, just at the downturn.
Exactly. You know, it definitely feels more like that. I mean, plus, you know, I'm kind of running in and murdering a lot of people. I mean, like, I don't kill the people who don't attack me, but I mean, I figure these guards and policemen probably have, like, regular lives, and so I'm kind of psychotic, I feel. And then, of course, there's, like, heartfelt moments that I, you know, have with Elizabeth, and then I run around and, like, loot around in the trash for 5 minutes trying to look for money. So, the game's definitely a little disjointed.
That's a little silly right there. I mean, you know, there's things you don't do in front of Elizabeth, but she allows you to eat, like, hot dogs from the garbage can. I guess that's normal. But overall, like, that character interaction is really good, too. When you first meet Elizabeth, all that is really great.
Yeah, I kind of... Sometimes she makes me feel like she's a Disney princess.
Well, maybe it's because she's spinning around that one scene with the dancing.
Yeah, she feels like... You know, I feel like she's Belle from Beauty and the Beast. Just makes it all the more bizarre with me running around looting in the garbage and like murdering, scores of people.
She looks more like Belle, but she acts more like Ariel. Because Ariel doesn't know anything about the human world, and she just goes out there and explores.
Part of my world.
Everything's interesting to her. To her, the same way. If you look at her interactions in the beach, and I'm sure other people have seen the beach scene, is if you walk around certain areas, she'll like jump to different things, try to do things like lift up the heavy ball, like talk about the guy's jumping jacks. Like, listening to women who are talking. If you just bring her anywhere, she'll just stand and do something. Like, the guy's not cotton candy. Sometimes she won't, sometimes she will get the cotton candy from the guy.
Yeah.
You just drag along with her as she walks. So, it's really cool what they've done with her. They make her not an escort mission. She's like, she's more like escorting you to the world than you escorting her. So I found that pretty cool. But again, we can't go in full discussion of it yet. Go ahead.
One part of BioShock that I am a bit perplexed about is the idea of the season pass. Because if you look at it on Steam, the game came with a season pass. You get, of course, day one DLC of new items and stuff. But then they talk about having more stories attached to it. And BioShock, at least from what I played the first one, it doesn't seem like a game that's meant to have these more stories. It seems to be more like a singular event. So, are you guys interested in playing like more DLC? Do you think that could fit within the universe?
Okay, well, I finished it, Evan has not. So let me just tell you that, in talking about Levine's comments on Season Pass, is he said that it's things to flesh out the world, add things to the story in between, obviously. Nothing, there's no additional to it, you know?
Okay.
So it's only it's just going to be just, you know, increase the lore, you know, more things to read.
Yeah, even without having finished the game, like, I mean, that would have been my guess, is that, you know, side stories with other characters and, you know, other events and kind of building more on those.
More along lines of, like, Deus Ex's Missing Link that took place halfway through the campaign instead of, you know, attaching, you know, two, 3 more hours.
Exactly. That's it. So, I mean, and just to say that the issues with BioShock, and to say, like, you know the current things with BioShock's issues, but it's been a lot of it's been fixed in Infinite.
Okay.
And a lot of the asinine things that were done in BioShock are fixed in Infinite because they understand the concept of narrative now. You know, the strengths of it. I think they have said a lot of money going into it. And by the way, I said it cost $200 million, but Levine just debunked it, like, yesterday. He said, like, $200 million, who wrote that check? So, there you go.
Now, I guess one final question for me about Infinite. I know earlier, both of you talked about the problems you had with BioShock 2, that it didn't feel like it added anything to the experience. Like, it felt like the story was already played out. So with that said, if they decide to do, you know, BioShock Infinite 2 in the exact same setting, would you guys be interested in playing that one?
Probably not. Other thing about BioShock 2 not being, you know, quite on par with the first one is, you know, it was a different development team. And, you know, I take developers, you know, very seriously. Like, BioShock 2 was the last time I said, I'm going to buy a sequel, you know, not caring that it has different developers. You know, the next time I'll probably wait and see how it is when it comes out. Conversely, if, you know, one of my favorite developers is making, like, a crazy cat lady simulator, like, I'm going to buy that, even though that doesn't sound like something I would play.
Because I know who you're talking about there.
Yeah.
But,
like, exploring Infinite again, I don't think I'd want to do that because, you know, I've already explored, you know, the world, and that's a lot of, you know, the fun of a BioShock game, and I think exploring, you know, doing the same thing is, you know, the wrong way. I mean, Half-Life 2 is, you know, viewed as a great sequel, but Half-Life 2 is very different in feel and very different in setting than Half-Life 1. And I think that's what makes it a good sequel.
Don't forget, the development team's the same, right? So, like, the I feel like BioShock 2 is more like they got a template and they work with it, you know? But in the end of the day, a template is just that. It's already been done. There's only so much you can do within its boundaries. There's no room to actually experiment or add something to the lore. It doesn't. It's just a prequel to the things happening in BioShock 1. And again, I just didn't think they made the right kind of decisions in terms of what the players wanted. Just what the players expected was there. But again, BioShock Infinite, fantastic, and let me just, I don't want to spoil anything, but I'm just saying that everything about BioShock that you love is in BioShock Infinite, but it's also infinitely better. Bam.
Another one for you right there.
Good.
Awesome.
Good. Oh yeah, and their themes are fantastic. I'm sure you're starting to look at some of the themes that they brought in so far, right?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I'm, you know, really enjoying it, and, you know, I'm really interested to see where it goes.
And that's
we'll spend, like, when I finish it, you know, we'll get more detailed on a future podcast.
Well, I'm just saying that they're starting to have some pretty respectful material, but they're one of the few, like, series that actually explores some great philosophical concepts, what ifs, While other games just are just there purely for entertainment. The only other game that I can think of that really makes a good statement, at least using the FPS, is probably Spec Ops.
Yeah definitely. Really definitely.
And that's also a good callback to last week's discussion when we talked about good world building. Both BioShock games, I think they are examples of good world building. You really get that sense that this place could have existed or wasn't, you know, just built, you know, 10 minutes ago for you to, you know, run around and play around it.
It's not around you.
And stuff is going on exactly around you and not just, because you're there. I mean, you're ultimately there messing everything up and, like, you know, kind of, you know, taking everything to the 10th degree. But, like, there was already this, like, you know, ecosystem and everything before you got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Was that your game of the week too, Ken?
Bioshock Infinite? That is my game of the week.
All right. So let's move on now for our topic. I know this one that Evan has been chomping at a bit to talk about.
Yep.
And it's all about competitions and basically competitive gaming. Now, I think we've mentioned this before, but Evan is on a pro TF2 team, right?
I mean, I wouldn't say, like, a pro TF2 team. There's any number of, like, competitive scenes out there. TF2 has its own competitive scene, but it's not, like, the be-all. You know, it's not, you know, on the same level of any of the other big games. But it has its own thing, and it has, you know, kind of two different systems, a 6v6 and a 9v9 system. 9v9 is called Highlander. There can be one of every class. So, you know, there's 9 classes in the game. Each team has one of each of them. But it's an easier format than any other one, so don't take this to think that, you know, I'm like, you know, God's gift to TF2 or anything. I've learned a ton in the past 2 months just by playing it, and it's, you know, really helped revitalize the game for me because I've been able to, like, instead of just crushing people on pubs, I'm actually, like, you know, faced with more of a challenge, forced to get better. But I'm on a UGC Steel team, which is, you know, Iron is the lowest, and then Steel, and then Silver and Gold and Platinum, and then you know, you start getting into 6v6 leagues and some of the other leagues. So I'm pretty, you know, I'm kind of just starting off on, you know, the competitive level of this stuff.
Okay. All right. So the post that I was on about this week was regarding sportsmanship in online games. And I think this is a pretty interesting topic because it's one that has really not gotten a lot of major discussions over the last few years.
Yeah.
As we've obviously, the three of us, we've been playing online games for a while now, and let's face it, it can be pretty nasty to be playing online with anonymous people.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, you know, different games, different systems, you know, have different sort of communities, but, you know, online can be quite a wasteland out there.
Yeah, I mean, who here hasn't, you know, heard a joke about Xbox Live's community?
Yeah, I mean, they're like the YouTube comments of communities. Because, like, usually the most ignorant comments and the most offensive comments come from anonymity, you know? And I feel that YouTube comments have gotten a little bit better purely because now that YouTube accounts are tied to your Gmail accounts.
Nice.
And your Gmail accounts is attached to all your social accounts. So your anonymity is still there. But if someone wants to, say, research you, they could easily find you.
Yeah.
So that's one thing.
Yeah, and I think that sort of tearing away the layers of anonymity over the last year is thanks to things like Steam and other developers having you actually have to tie yourself to these accounts. So you can't just, you know, create 10 phony accounts and play games. You have to tie everything to your own account with your specific information. That has somewhat helped.
Right.
So the piece that I brought up from the post was regarding the difference between the StarCraft II League that was going on, that was the first big tournament of 2013, and a post from Eurogamer where they were showing the teams acting out at a Call of Duty Black Ops 2 tournament. Did both of you watch that video I put up?
Yeah, the Black Ops video? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was just, you know, for, like, everyone talking about the problems with, you know, online gaming and stuff like that. I mean, that was pretty much, you know, right up there, you know, poster child example, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the stereotype that we need to get away from as gamers. Because that's what everyone thinks that we do, is that we all we do is play first-person shooters, we catch shot, and we scream at people. And that's just, that's what people are. Either that stereotypical gamer, and that's seen, by the way, and I feel like media says that's like the, not only a general way to look at gamers, but the more positive, because the media's representation of negative gamers is the one that play D&D by themselves in their basement.
Yeah, we get negative stereotypes no matter which way we go.
Yeah, both of them are terrible, but they think that the other one's better. And there's a lot of movies that just reinforces it, you know? There's that gamer movie that came out. It wasn't called Gamer, because that's
it was called Gamer,
yeah.
No, this is like four kids on a road trip or something, right?
That was a different one, I think.
Yeah. There's a movie with that, with four kids that wouldn't become, like, professionals, whatever, in some sort of gaming league. And they just go over every stereotype possible.
Was that the one with Jason Mewes in it?
I have no idea, but it got like -5 stars. it was brutally bad.
Yeah, I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah, it was just like a movie created by a director who had no idea about games, but had his like cousin that played games give him all his references. So it was just terrible. So like we need to really clean up our image, but things like this with MLG, not MLG, but at least this tournament with Black Ops sets us backwards. So yeah. People look at us as just giant man children, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's going to be even harder for us to, you know, to get people to take esports seriously and to, you know, want to sponsor us and, you know, really actually grow the scene.
Yeah, especially when we look at last year with the Street Fighter controversy, when the guy said, you know, that sexism and misogyny is a part of the culture.
Did you say integral part? Because that's a terrible word to use.
I think so.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'll say this, as far as, like, competitive communities go. I mean, you know, every scene's a little bit different, and, you know, no scene's necessarily better than any of the other ones. You know, like, as much as I'd like to trash LOL for, you know, having one of the most vile scenes there, Riot has done some interesting stuff to help self-police. And, you know, Riot's also putting a ton of money behind the competitive scene, and they're really doing a great job with that. So even though League of Legends isn't really up my alley, you know, hats off to them. The fighting game scene's, you know, completely different. I mean, you know, competitive gaming more or less starts with fighting games. And if you watched the PAX 2013 panel by DJ Wheat and Leaf Slasher, you know, their whole thing on the history of competitive gaming, they even say, you know, with the exception of guys competing for high scores, you know, fighting games starts. But, you know, fighting games are different in that the scene grew up without the internet. Even when other genres started to get popular with online play, you know, the amount of ping that makes a first-person shooter, you know, the amount of ping that you can deal with in a first-person shooter would render a fighting game unplayable.
Definitely.
Yeah, and so it's not until, like, this generation that we've really taken online fighting seriously for fighting games with GGPO's netcode. Anyway, so the fighting game community is both simultaneously friendlier than some of the other game communities while at the same time more vile. It's a much more diverse and much more kind of accepting community. You know, this is coming from you're sitting right next to the person face to face, so you can't get too crazy with your language. You couldn't get away with the sort of stuff that flies on League of Legends or Xbox Live. At the same time, like League of Legends, you know, you can lose your match because a teammate screws something up, and so like you just wasted your hour for nothing. Whereas a fighting game, it's just you and it's just the opponent, and it's over in 5 minutes.
Also, with League of Legends, to add on to that, there's also the ranking system, the ELO system. So one bad loss not only ruins an hour, it can ruin, you know, your next several matches. They need to build your skill back up so you can play in the teams you were accustomed to.
I bet a lot of the erroneous things that happen in League of Legends is probably from the ranked matches. I'm sure, like, regular matches probably aren't as vile.
I've had friends, you know, Left 4 Dead friends get into, like, huge screaming matches on, you know, a regular match, so not quite sure about that.
Okay, it's still there, I guess. But, you know, you make a good point about the fighting games, you know, being one of the first, and when you sit next to somebody and you see them face-to-face, like, there's a certain level of respect you have for one another when you start a match. It's just like in a karate. You bow to your opponent. You're not there just to beat them up. You respect his,
yeah,
you respect him, and you fight, and then it's over, and you're people again.
Yeah, yeah, like with
a level of sportsmanship with StarCraft II, watching the matches, like they, you know, shake hands. If there was a problem, like the two guys were sportsmen enough to, you know, stop playing or, you know, admit that, you know, if I don't want to have an advantage playing against this guy, won't be in fair and square deal.
Right, because that's the only really way to win. At least in that kind of match. But again, when you play, say, a fighting game like that, when you're next to the person, but as soon as you go online, you don't have the kind of limits.
Yeah.
So,
and admittedly, you know, the fighting game scene can be a little bit more bitter online, but not all the time. You know, there's games that I've seen where, you know, a bunch of hardcore guys, you know, start a room of six and they're all on mic and then, you know, like trash talking just like they were like next to each other. Like the fighting game scene has always had like trash talk, but ultimately, you know, a lot of respect for people's, for other opponents. Because, you know, if the other guy's good, you know, he's good, you know, respect. The community is terrible to Justin Wong. Like, everybody just loves to see him lose, and it's terrible, because he's really the best player in the States. And
we just
all make fun of him when he loses, and keep bringing up, the, you know, Evo 2004, and, I mean, we're just terrible to him.
Oh, that was a great video, though.
It really, really is.
That's like, that's like one of gaming's moments for some reason. Like
yeah,
that like comeback was so amazing. It's like everyone could feel that one.
Is that the Chung Li and Ken one?
That's it.
Yeah, Diego.
I love watching that one.
And well, here's the thing that you may not understand unless you're like really good at Street Fighter 3 Third Strike. That super that Chung Li's doing, which was absolutely the right move. Like Justin Wong, like should not have done anything but that move. It counts as instantaneous, so you cannot parry it on reaction. So Daigo did not say, oh, he's doing the super, let me parry. Daigo is moving back and forth, hoping that the super will come out as he happens to just have tapped forward, and thus he'll get the parry, and then he just has to, you know, maintain the same rhythm to parry everything else. So yeah, like, that's even more impressive if you weren't aware of that. And I mean, it's those sort of moments that, you know, are why we're here talking about esports. And it's, you know, games need to have those sort of, you know, consistent games have to have that sort of plays every time they're being played. You know, if we think of like what makes, actual sports, you know, entertaining, it's, you know, those sort of breakaway plays.
One thing I really love about that and other MLG stuff and stuff like that, or just like commentaries online, just having commenters to begin with. And especially if you know the game, if you don't know the game, it's just interesting. If you know the game, it's intriguing.
Yeah,
because you're seeing the game played through someone else's eyes and someone else's perspective, and then someone giving like professional commentary on techniques that maybe you didn't even aware of. But you're already engaged when you watch a game to begin with because it's meant to be entertainment. But to take it and put it in that kind of format of sports is really interesting.
Yeah. I think one of my favorites was during the MLG tournaments, day 9 was doing a lot of the commentary. Mm-hmm. And even like his regular day 9 casts have always been like a very informative look at StarCraft 2. And there's a lot of things you would never really learn or realize if you didn't have, you know, like that third opinion, you know, looking down at everything objectively.
The guys who do commentary on TF2 matches are really good too.
Gotta send me a link to a good one, by the way. I need to find a good channel for that.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean that's the other thing about like what's really making esports special is the fact that anybody can start streaming and, you know, get popular that way. One of the things they talk about at the Penn Arcade, at the PAX East, you know, seminar is they talk about, you know, now that, you know, all these streaming sites are taking off, you know, journalists are coming and being like, oh, so when are video games going to be on TV? And you know, the big thing is like, we're better than that. We don't need to be on that, you know, because that's just going to limit us. We've already moved past this to where, you know, anybody can start a streaming channel. And, you know, if they're a high level player and they've got something to say, you know, that's pretty big.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do have a few questions regarding competitive games. Hoping you can help, you know, shed some light on.
Sure.
I guess the first one is, as we talked about a few weeks ago, MLG is looking at designing a game specifically for competitive games. Normally, when we look at games like Street Fighter or StarCraft, these games weren't built, you know, in their original sense for competitive games. They sort of fell into that role. Do you think What do you think about having a game that was that's designed basically from day one as a competitive game? Do you think something like that will do well in the market?
Well, yes and no. I mean, for one thing, you know, we need, you know, to get one game that's going to be, you know, that's going to dwarf everything else. Because as impressive as, you know, some of this stuff is, like League of Legends getting like 2 million people watching, that's not real consistent numbers yet. You know, that's not something that's going to ever put us on par with, you know, actual sporting events. Even, you know, the smaller ones that nobody cares about. So we still need to, you know, grow our numbers. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to need is a game that's, you know, easy to understand, even if you don't have an intimate knowledge of it. But also, you know, interesting to watch. You know, we're going to need really good spectator modes. You know, really good, you know, player aids that make it, you know, as entertaining to watch as it is to play. Now, I will say the other thing about it is if you make a game that's geared only towards the most hardcore people, you may end up shooting yourself in the foot. Because if not enough people play it, like if it's not easy for a casual person to at least start playing something and having some sort of fun in it, you may just not get enough people playing to begin with. I mean, we might have enough for, you know, a handful of top level teams and, you know, some really hardcore players, and there might only be a comp scene, but is that going to be enough if you don't immediately have a huge amount of spectators for it?
Yeah. And one thing that we saw over the last few years regarding the real-time strategy genre, there's a really big push last decade to, I guess, sort of follow in the footsteps of StarCraft. We saw developers like EA, they basically took a lot of their designs with Command & Conquer, and they were basically trying to force the competitive aspect into these games. They made them more micro-focused, they had more ways to view it, and I think, personally, I think it backfired on them because it made the games into something that they really weren't. Yeah. When you play like something like Command Conquer or Red Alert 2 or Number 4, it just felt different compared to the previous games in the series.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, you know, any game that gets designed, as much as, like, you know, you should keep an eye towards balancing at the, you know, highest level, I think your game still needs to be easy enough to jump into that the casual player can, you know, start playing and have an idea, just so you initially have, you know, a sort of player base, a user base. I mean, think of any, like, regular professional, like, physical sport. Your average person doesn't have any idea how to play football at the professional level, but it's pretty easy to get a football, toss it around, and, you know, have an idea for how it flies, you know, have a quick pickup game and, you know, have a sort of understanding. And if the game is only interesting at the highest level of play, or, you know, only... can only possibly be played at that level and doesn't work in a casual setting at all, I think, you know, that game is going to fail right out of the gate. So they need to be careful about that.
Yeah, they need to generate interest in some way.
Yeah.
If the wall of boundary is too high, why would they even engage? Like, to me, even though League of Legends, only reason League of Legends is interesting to me is because everyone raves about it, right? But it also scares me because they talk about all the horror stories that comes along with it. Like, the community and stuff like that, and how people put so much weight on unranked matches and stuff like that. And if you look at it from the outside, you have no idea how to play MOBAs. It's actually a very daunting game.
Yeah.
And of course, as we talk about, the learning curve is so high that it's just very tough to learn the game without, you know, pissing off, you know, seven other people playing it with you.
And again,
or whatever the actual numbers are for that.
And whenever I'll tell people about that, they always say just play with friends, and they'll solve your situation.
Yeah, but that's still not a perfect solution, because what if your friends are, you know, as interested in ranks as everyone else is?
Exactly. I mean, it is...
What if your friends play TF2 instead, because they're cool people?
Yeah, I'll play TF2, but, yeah, I mean, I think that's another issue, too. That's not a real, like, encompassing solution. It is a solution based on situation.
Yeah. But, so yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if MLG can actually, you know, get a development team together that wants to put it out, you know, as long as the game still is worthwhile playing at a casual level, I mean, you know, partner up with somebody who needs to make a new game. I mean, Quake hasn't had a good entry lately. Let's have a new Quake.
There is a new Quake coming out. I forget the name, but they straight up PAX. Really cool.
Well, there you go.
I'll look it up.
All right. So I guess another part of the post I was talking about was a response that the Electronic Sports League had regarding, you know, everything that was shown in a Eurogamer video. And the quote that I picked out was this: "This is no different to sports such as football and rugby, where competitive spirit and banter are part of the mind games that take place between different teams."
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, I have to call BS on that as well. Because I think, as we talk about, I mean, most people who play these games, I mean, the level that we see, like, the bile thrown at people, I think it's just completely uncalled for.
Yeah, yeah. Professionals in sports are typically, I mean, like, they may, like, they trash talk, but they don't, like, trash talk. They, you know, they generally have respect for other players, and, like, you never see, like, racial slurs or anything like that, because instantly these guys would then lose their jobs and get blackballed, and, well, I mean, typically, I mean, we do have the football player who killed somebody and the other one with the dog fighting, so, but, you know, whatever. It, you know, at the same time, like, the sort of things that were said there, they would have gotten fined in any other organization, and esports aren't making enough money, you know, to really, you know, to really actually start fining people. You know, when people are get to the point where, like, you know, they're on team steadily and, like, everybody playing in these tournaments is on a team that they can actually make money off of it, not just the winners, I think that's when we're going to truly have arrived. But at the same time, you know, we're never going to get there if we're, you know, acting like, if we're throwing around, you know, racial slurs, sexist slurs, or anything like that.
I see a few things. One, we have to destroy that stigma with games, with gamers, as, you know, those guys in that video.
Yeah.
Another thing, too, is we need a platform, like a universal platform, similar to how everyone can figure out football. It's like, just like what MLG is trying to do. And another one is a superstar for that platform.
Yeah.
Someone that's very recognizable, easily seen within all communities, and just general populace.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what.
Go ahead.
You know, the other thing we need is, I think we need a sense of tribalism, a sense of belonging, right? So,
definitely.
You know, like, I'll watch competitive TF2 matches, and I don't have any loyalty towards any of them. Whereas, like, a good portion of, like, being a football fan is talking about how your team is better than whatever other team you're either playing against that week or you have a rivalry with. I mean, we're all near Philly, and, I mean, how crazy are Eagles fans, right?
Stab people.
Whereas, like, I don't know what TF2 team I should back. You know, unless I know one of the players playing at the highest level, you know, they're all the same to me, you know? Solid Snake is my favorite demo player because I like the name Solid Snake because I like Metal Gear. That's as far as that goes.
Well, you know what I actually really liked watching? There was a commentary on YouTube Stars.
Yeah.
So they had Yogscast and some, like, people that worked at Valve, and, you know, they had just different people, like, some people from Riot Games were there. So a bunch of, like, people that you might know or may or may not, or have come from a respectable background, are playing in a charity match. I thought that was really engaging because I actually could root for people in that situation.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
But I think, again, that's another big thing. It's like, they need exposure. These people need exposure.
Yeah, yeah. And admittedly, you know, we get some of it on, the worldwide scene, but, I mean, that only works for, like, the biggest championships, you know? It's not like, you know, like, Evo, we get once a year for the fighting game guys, but, you know, but there's nothing like a regular season where you could watch stuff. And, once, maybe twice a year, U.S. and Japan get a square off against each other. But let's be real, the fighting game scene still makes fun of Justin Wong. You know, a couple years ago when he got, when he went 0-2 in Street Fighter 4, well, not 0-2, but I mean, lost terribly, they took a video of his loss and then just put, like, a voiceover of him talking about how trash the character he lost to was. And how, like, that character wasn't viable in tournaments. Like, we're not rooting for the people representing us on a national level nearly as much as we should. And I think, you know, that's the sort of thing that can really get people fired up. And, you know, it's going to help with merchandising. And, like, somebody doesn't want to just, you know, buy a League of Legends shirt. They want to buy a League of Legends shirt that, you know, has a particular team represented on it.
That would be interesting to see, like, if we eventually reach that point. Where we have, you know, jerseys or shirts the same way as, you know, sports football fans, you know, they buy their favorite, you know, team's shirt or jersey, you know, in all the sports stores.
Well, look at South Korea. Like that's already happening there. They have $1 million sponsorships for StarCraft players. And the thing is that the only reason it's not accepted here is they don't have that stigma that we do. They also have a really powerful, like, they have really great internet there, too.
Yeah.
We have no competition in terms of, you know, our connections. So until they increase that level and have more people online, and we destroy that stigma, I don't think we'll be able to get that level.
The other thing to keep in mind, you know, when we're comparing, like, how any sort of scene is in a much smaller country, is just kind of understanding that, I mean, you know, just because of how the, you know, how big the U.S. is, you know, it very quickly can weaken a player base by splintering it too much, you know, if it's something incredibly online play reliant. I mean, you see that all over with fighting games where, like, there's different regions that always play against each other, but, you know, except for flying off and, you know, playing every couple of, you know, months against each other, you know, they don't really interact. So, like, a smaller fighting game that might work in a big city won't work in a suburbs because there's only going to be three or four people playing it. Case in point, though, one of my friends who I wanted to get on for this because he's really active in the, you know, in the 2D fighting game scene, shout out to the Dynamic Entry crew and Nas, But he's actually in Atlanta right now, you know, at a fighting game tournament. So that's going to be like the, you know, hit, you know, Delaware and Philly, you're going to go down and play against the guys from the South. And so, like, that's a cool thing, you know. Can we get to the point where this stuff is getting streamed to the point that, like, people are, like, really rooting for, like, their region?
Maybe. I think another that's also hurting is somewhat of the issue with as we talk about, the internet access. I mean, if you look at trying to play... fighting anything online with Xbox, you of course need to pay for the subscription. So that makes, like, the PlayStation a little bit better, but then you have to worry about internet connection speeds. And as you mentioned earlier, this generation is, like, the first time we actually had internet speeds capable of playing, like, fighting games online.
Yeah.
I remember it was such, like, a big deal when we saw, I think, what was, like, the first fighting game that had that war? Was it Street Fighter 4 or Mortal Kombat for this generation?
Blaze Blue. Or maybe Battle Fantasia. No, I don't think that had GGPO netcode. I think BlazBlue was the first one that had had good netcode, to be honest. I know Street Fighter 4 had input delay on its netcode. And so that was a real big problem. You know, like, I could jump as Zangief and do a, you know, a 720 and hit my buttons, and then by the time I landed, it would just happen to work. Even though I should not have finished the input that early. There's a netcode that some guys who, from what I understand, you know, feel free to correct me in comments, guys, if I'm wrong about this. From what I understand, they built this netcode for, like, some emulation they were doing, or for some, like, you know, indie PC fighting games called GGPO, Good Game Peace Out. And that netcode, you know, it's a big deal whenever some publisher says, oh, yeah, we're using, you know, GGPO-style netcode, because it does a really good job of working with lag. I don't know how Mortal Kombat 9's netcode turned out, but I know Street Fighter 4 was really bad, and it's gotten better in, you know, each iteration of Street Fighter 4. I know King of Fighters, when it first dropped, I want to say 12, had pretty bad netcode, which wasn't good. But I've had really good success with BlazBlue and all of Arc's fighters. So, I mean, you know, really, you know, but still, it's just this generation is the first time that we have had that decent netcode. You know, I had it worth playing. We had, you know, CVS 2 on the regular Xbox, and that netcode was just atrocious. It was impossible to play like that. And for games that require this sort of, like, split-second timing, I mean, this is why the fighting game community, you know, is already used to traveling across the, you know, across the country just for these, like, big regional get-togethers, because that's the only way you can get, you know, the people from New York to play the people from Atlanta.
Well, it's also part of the culture, too. Because originally it started off with, you know, you side by side with somebody.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have the same kind of the tournament feel than it would if it was just online.
I mean, there's something to be said for, like, the sort of energy that happens at these tournaments and all that. And, I mean, and, you know, to be fair, you can understand why, you know, women typically didn't get into the genre. Because, I mean, it literally does require, you know, standing, you know, in a dark room surrounded by, like, 100 guys who probably need to use deodorant, at best.
True.
And so, you know, I can understand, you know, guys who are a little bit, you know, threatened by, you know, suddenly girls starting to pick up. I really think that, you know, with how fighting games are developing now, I think girls should, you know, women should make a push into the scene. But you can understand why there aren't already more in the scene, you know, given that it's, you know, you're right next to the person, it's cramped, it's always hot. I mean, it's just terrible. But it's part of the culture, and I'll tell you what, like, you know, I've never seen, like, that much energy as, you know, at, like, a big fighting game, you know, get-together.
Right. And you look at that video with Daigo and Wong.
Let's go, Justin!
Exactly. You hear that. You hear that. Exactly.
Yeah. I watched Justin Wong lose $1,000 on a money match once.
Wow. Okay. How do you look after that?
Well, he was the top player in Marvel's Capcom 2 at the time. This is way before Marvel's Capcom 3. And the guy who was the best at playing, I guess, Marvel's Capcom 1 online challenged him to a match and pulled out a secret character that Wong didn't know how to deal with.
Oh.
And he pulled out Mecha Zangief, and Wong lost $1,000 on a money match and then didn't enter any tournaments that day.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
What a surprise that was.
Yeah, well, and again, like, I don't know why, like, you know, the Japanese players are like, you know, we worship our best player because he's our best player. He's what we aspire to. Us Americans are like, man, screw Wong. Meanwhile, like, Gutex gets away with charging, like, $100 an hour to, like, you know, have him teach you how to play Street Fighter better.
Nice. I should try that sometime. See what actually tells me. But, you know, again, that whole, like, worship thing, you know, there's, like, a level of, it's a cultural thing. Because in Asia, a big thing that we're missing in America is respect in general. Like, a big, the whole cornerstone of most of their society is built on respect, right? And our society is about the focus on the self, the individual, right? There's no, like, tiers, really. Your respect has to be earned. So,
yep.
I mean, and also, I mean, people love to hate, you know? There's always haters out there.
Yeah.
And if someone's doing better than you, you always want them to do worse so you can feel better about yourself, so... That's also part of it. So if he can falter, if this god of gaming can falter, then you seem less fragile.
Yeah.
You know, you seem better. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm picking up what you're putting down.
But, I mean, again, for it to become successful, sportsmanship definitely needs to be, and talk about, going back to what we originally talked about, we talked about that there's such, like, vitriol in most online communities. But can you guys think of any communities where everyone's pretty pleasant for the most part? Or overall, like, there's not really... Can you guys think of any?
TF2 is the most pleasant I found.
Yeah, I'm actually the same way. But that's because I don't jump server to server. I just stay on No Heroes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, when it comes and goes, like, I think the casual scene was a lot better before the game went free to play. Like your random pubs were a little bit better. As the competitive scene has gotten bigger, you know, I think it's, you know, I really like being a part of the competitive scene. I find that a lot of the really good teams and really better players are actually, like, really nice and really helpful. But, like, you know, the teams in our division that have completely rolled us, a number of them have kind of been jerks. And I, you know, I try to be above that. I try to be, you know, a really good sportsman just in general. But, you know, it's, you know, I've gotten so much help from, like, the competitive TF2 subreddit and all the people there. And, you know, we had numerous, you know, plat and silver and gold level players and, you know, even higher than that, like, stop by and watch our matches and give us commentary and notes. And it's, you know, it's been a really, really pleasant community. And I think, you know, part of that might be that it's just, you know, it's a small community to begin with. It's definitely getting bigger, and I mean, there's still, you know, places that, you know, people aren't as friendly. Like TF2 lobby can be a little rough around the edges at times, you know, it's kind of weird for me going back to the pub servers that I used to be on, because a lot of the regular guys there are now on a competitive team too, and so they're not playing there anymore. And I go back, and it's all completely different people, and they all think they're really good, and then get mad at me because I just crush them.
Let's see what
like,
you do.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm wasting my time here. If I'm the best player on the server, then I'm on the wrong server. I got to find some place that's going to kill me more often. So I've started playing in different servers just as a result.
Yeah, if I'm ever on top of the team, I know we're in trouble. I always see that.
Yeah.
If we're on top of the team, we're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, it's like, well, you know, and then I'll try to switch to, you know, off class and I'll go sniper or something and, you know. you know, try to work on some area that I'm deficient at. But, you know, there's sometimes I just got to play soldier. So I got to find, you know, servers where, you know, people are really challenging me more. And, you know, I'm, you know, forced to, like, level up my reaction time and my aim and, you know, my prediction and something else.
Yeah, this sometimes you find the most challenge are the randomest servers. One time I joined a friend's server. I guess he was playing on a furry server. I don't know why he was playing on a furry server.
Oh no, they've got some good some good competition on the furry pound.
Yeah, they're actually really good. I'm like, wow. Yeah. I'm surprised. They're just like, you know, in No Heroes, like top like 5 or 6 are like regulars, but for them it feels like the top 15 are pretty decent. They all know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I do kind of feel that way. I feel on any No Hero server, there's a handful of people, you know, up to maybe 12 at top. You know, just who regularly play on the server who, you know, are the good players, and everybody else is just kind of there.
Especially when you see three snipers at the bottom, you're like,
always. Stars East Coast is a really good one, and Reddit East Coast is really solid, so shout out to both of those servers. The Furry Pound is good. There's also a. Like, at the same time, like, I was looking for a random server, and I stumbled across a deathmatch server and find out it was owned by a UGC silver team. And I was like, oh, cool. So we're going to deathmatch against the silver team while we're warming up for our steel match. This is cool. And it was totally cool. Like, you know, I mean, they were clearly better than us, but, like, the guys weren't, like, mean or anything. So, you know, it's a pretty friendly community. But, I mean, TF2 is also, like the Smash Brothers of first-person shooters, except, you know, real first-person shooters just kind of ignore us. Whereas, you know, in the fighting game scene, the real fighting game scene kind of trash talks Smash Brothers, and those scenes don't mingle at all. Like, they do not like each other.
I'm pretty sure they don't. And, again, like, the competitive Smash Brothers game, to me it feels like it takes a soul out of Smash Brothers. Because, like, as a developer, like, they developed all their mechanics around items, situational events, adaptation. Like, that's, like, the main things that they made the game about. Yeah. But everyone plays, like, all right, we'll play a game, new items, Final Destination, that's it. I'm like, So it's, like, always the same game.
It just becomes really repetitive after a while.
So all it is a bunch of people blocking and rolling back and forth.
Yeah.
And then waiting for them at the edge. Yeah.
You know, at the same time, I think, you know, ultimately, the kind of game that's going to be, like, the most runaway success in esports is going to be a game that, you know, has a level of simplicity like that and doesn't have the sort of variation of TF2 or Smash Brothers, just to make it easier to follow. You know, so I think we're ultimately going to see something like that is going to be what takes off. But at the same time, I'm with you. You know, like, I like Highlander more than 66 because there's more items that are allowed. And every class is represented. That's as far as it goes. I like seeing the diversity, even though I understand that a more stripped down and, you know, skill-focused game would ultimately be better for high-level play. You know, it's like you said, I feel like, you know, a game that wasn't designed around that to begin with kind of loses some of its soul.
Yeah. And that actually is going to lead into my other question that I have for you, Evan. Is, in the past, we've talked about how different it is when you're playing Team Fortress 2 competitively versus when you're just playing casually. I know we had a discussion, I think, when Ken got into argument with someone regarding his, I guess, loadout for, I think, Spy versus what this competitive guy would do.
Yeah.
My question is, because, I mean, we talk about analyzing games a lot. I know I do it for my reviews for learning about game design. How is it about analyzing a game when you're learning it competitively? Like, what's, like, the general thought process when you're playing a game and you're looking at it to basically develop your own competitive skills?
Well, I mean, it's very much going to be dependent on what sort of game it is, and not only, you know, what sort of game, like, what sort of genre, but also how big the gap is between what you need to do for high-level play and what you need to do for, you know, casual play. If casual play is very different than high-level play, or if there's kind of, like, a big gap, you know, that can be, you know, a problem. To give you an idea, like, if you're playing, like, Street Fighter 4, the gap between, you know, being pretty good at the game and actually being, like, truly tournament worthy is pretty big. And you don't even understand, like, what it is, but it's like, you can't even recognize it, even if you put in the massive amount of time to perfect the timing to get your, like, 1 and 2 frame links down. you know, they're still like, you know, knowing what move to do when. We had a guy who used to come over for Friday night fights who, this guy named Ren, who, he didn't seem like he was ever doing anything special, but, he would always know, like, what punch to already have hit and already have his fist out there as you recovered from blocking and wanted to do something, and, like, he just, and you wouldn't even understand why you were losing to him. And so, like, it's ultimately why I stopped playing Street Fighter, because the gap between those levels was too big for me. Whereas Blaze Blue, I could immediately jump in and immediately do a pretty good combo, and I could learn how to land hits, and it was just a matter of slowly, like, extending those combos so every hit I landed was a little bit more effective as I played, and it was easier to, like, learn as I went. Competitive TF2 is a little weird in that you can run around on a pub and bottom feed and kill, like, low-end players really easily and not have to worry about, like, an organized team, and then suddenly have to worry about an organized team. Like, where you are on the map at any given time matters a ton more, and your individual deathmatch skill matters a ton more. And so there's kind of a big gap, but not a huge one. Not nearly like something like Street Fighter.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. When I was watching like a Marvel vs. Capcom, I think that was 3. When I was watching like the tournaments, those things were, it was just felt like really chaotic. But at the same time, it sort of got a point where it seemed like everyone was just picking like the same 3 player group, and just like, you know, we're picking like the same, you know, as massive infinity combos as possible.
Well, I mean, like, Marvel has its own, you know, like, there's a pretty decent number of, like, different team designs you can do. And, you know, to a degree, they'll, you know, occasionally, like, that sort of game will have, a sort of meta that comes out where, like, one team becomes the best, then somebody finds a team that's really good at shutting that team down. So, like, that sort of happens, too. But Marvel's actually really good. Like, I like Marvel a lot, even though I don't play it anymore. But it's a really well-done game, and... You know, as chaotic as it seems, it's not that hard to learn everything that's going on there. You know, the timings aren't, you know, incredibly strict on a lot of stuff. You know, you spend a little bit, it's pretty easy to learn all of the combos that you would need to on your, for your character, you know, if you've got, you know, a week to learn, you know, to spend on it. And so, like, I feel like the gap isn't as huge in that game as it is in other ones, like Dream Fighter 4, for example, or even like older games like Quake, where like positioning on the map matters a lot more, and like paying attention to like what power up comes when. Like those things are like, you know, really hard to learn if you're first like starting to play a game, and you'll lose terribly if you don't understand those concepts. Whereas, you know, a lot of modern first person shooters, and this is what we talked about the other week, where the skill gap is, you know, a lot lowered in those. Yeah. A game like Call of Duty, you don't have to worry about that because the game does everything for you. No?
Yeah, man. Quake was so all about memorization of where things were to get to a certain item first before anybody else. And also the speed if you can get to it. And also you have to time it all in your head when it's going to respawn.
Yeah.
And that was a big part of Quake.
I mean, I do it in, like, pub TF2 all the time. Like, you know, I'll run around King of the Hill Mask and, like, just camp the medium health pack and just do that and get, like, you know, shoot feet, get kills.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's all my questions. Do you guys want to wrap it up at this point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
All right, do you have any final thoughts, either of you?
I think...
No, I think we're good. I think we covered everything.
Okay. All right. In that case, we're going to end the cast here. I'd like to once again thank Ken and Evan for being on.
Thank you for having me.
Yep.
And I believe for next week's preview, I think we're going to finally have our sexism topic next week. Is that right, Ken?
Well, we'll see who we can get. I have a couple in the living, so we'll see.
And for those of you listening, as always, if you're interested in either writing for Game Wisdom or being a guest on the podcast, feel free to send us an email. You can click on the Submissions Wanted link on our front page, and you'll find a contact form there. All right. So, once again, thanks for tuning in, and we will talk to you again next week.